A Nazi Kidnapping and a Beerhouse Bomb. 12 minutes after Hitler had finished making his annual speech, on the evening of November 8th, to the Old Guard party cronies at the Bürgerbräukeller in Munich in commemoration of the 1923 Beer Hall Putsch, a shorter speech than usual, a bomb which had been planted in a pillar directly behind the speaker's platform exploded, killing 7 persons and wounding 63 others. By that time, all the important Nazi leaders, with Hitler at their head, had hurriedly left the premises, though it had been their custom in former years to linger over their beers and reminisce with old party comrades about the early putsch. The next morning, Hitler's own paper, the Völkischer Beobachter, alone carried the story of the attempt on the Führer's life. It blamed the British Secret Service and even Chamberlain for the foul deed. "The attempted assassination," I wrote that evening in my diary, "undoubtedly will buck up public opinion behind Hitler and stir up hatred of England. Most of us think it smells of another Reichstag fire." What connection could the British Secret Service have with it, outside of Goebbels's feverish mind? An attempt was made at once to connect them. An hour or two after the bomb went off in Munich, Heinrich Himmler, chief of the SS and the Gestapo, telephoned to one of his rising young SS subordinates, Walter Schellenberg, at Dusseldorf, and ordered him by command of the Führer to cross the border into Holland the next day and kidnap 2 British Secret Service agents with whom Schellenberg had been in contact. Himmler's order led to one of the most bizarre incidents of the war. For more than a month, Schellenberg, who, like Alfred Naujax, was a university-educated intellectual gangster, had been seeing in Holland 2 British intelligence officers, Captain S. Payne Best and Major R. H. Stevens. To them he posed as Major Schemmel, an anti-Nazi officer in OKW, Schellenberg took the name from a living major, and gave a convincing story of how the German generals were determined to overthrow Hitler. What they wanted from the British, he said, were assurances that the London government would deal fairly with the new anti-Nazi regime. Since the British had heard from other sources, as we have seen, of a German military conspiracy, whose members wanted the same kind of assurances, London was interested in developing further contacts with Major Schemmel. Best and Stevens provided him with a small radio transmitter and receiving set. There were numerous ensuing communications over the wireless and further meetings in various Dutch towns. By November 7th, when the 2 parties met at Venlo, a Dutch town on the German frontier, the British agents were able to give Schemmel a rather vague message from London to the leaders of the German resistance, stating in general terms the basis for a just peace with an anti-Nazi regime. It was agreed that Schemmel would bring one of these leaders, a German general, to Venlo the next day to begin definitive negotiations. This meeting was put off to the 9th. Up to this moment, the objectives of the 2 sides were clear. The British were trying to establish direct contact with the German military putschists in order to encourage and aid them. Himmler was attempting to find out through the British who the German plotters were and what their connection was with the enemy secret service. That Himmler and Hitler were already suspicious of some of the generals as well as of men like Oster and Canaris of the Abwehr is clear. But now, on the night of November 8th, Hitler and Himmler found need of a new objective. Kidnap Best and Stevens and blame these 2 British Secret Service agents for the Bürgerbräu bombing. A familiar character now entered the scene. Alfred Naujax, who had staged the Polish attack on the German radio station at Gliwice, showed up in command of a 12 security service, SD, toughs, to help Schellenberg carry out the kidnapping. The deed came off nicely. At 4 p.m. on November 9th, while Schellenberg sipped an aperitif on the terrace of a café at Venlo, waiting for a rendezvous with Best and Stevens, the 2 British agents drove up in their Buick, parked it behind the café, and then ran into a hail of bullets from an SS car filled with Naujax ruffians. Lieutenant Klopp, a Dutch intelligence officer who had always accompanied the British pair in their talks with Schellenberg, fell mortally wounded. Best and Stevens were tossed into the SS car like bundles of hay, as Schellenberg later remembered, along with the wounded Klopp, and driven speedily across the border into Germany. According to the official Dutch account, which came to light after the war, the British car, with Stevens, Best, and Klopp in it, was towed by the Germans across the frontier, which was only 125 feet away. Starting on November 10th, the next day, the Dutch government made 9 written requests at frequent intervals for the return of Klopp and the Dutch chauffeur of the car, and also demanded a German investigation of this violation of Dutch neutrality. No reply was ever made until May 10th, when Hitler justified his attack on the Netherlands partly on the grounds that the Venlo affair had proven the complicity of the Dutch with the British Secret Service. Klopp died from his wounds a few days later. Best and Stevens survived 5 years in Nazi concentration camps. And so, on November 21st, Himmler announced to the public that the assassination plot against Hitler at the Bürgerbräukeller had been solved. It was done at the instigation of the British Intelligence Service, two of whose leaders, Stevens and Best, had been arrested on the Dutch-German frontier on the day following the bombing. The actual perpetrator was given as Georg Elser, a German communist carpenter residing in Munich. Himmler's detailed account of the crime sounded fishy to me, as I wrote in my diary the same day, but his accomplishment was very real. What Himmler and his gang are up to, obviously, I jotted down, is to convince the gullible German people that the British government tried to win the war by murdering Hitler and his chief aides. The mystery of who arranged the bombing has never been completely cleared up. Elser, though not the half-wit that was Marinus von der Lubbe of the Reichstag fire, was a man of limited intelligence, though quite sincere. He not only pleaded guilty to making and setting off the bomb, he boasted of it. Though, of course, he had never met Best and Stevens prior to the attempt, he did make the former's acquaintance during long years at the Sachsenhausen concentration camp. There he told the Englishman a long and involved, and not always logical, story. One day in October at the Dachau concentration camp, where he had been incarcerated since midsummer as a communist sympathizer, he related, he had been summoned to the office of the camp commandant, where he was introduced to 2 strangers. They explained the necessity of doing away with some of the Führer's traitorous followers by exploding a bomb in the Bürgerbräukeller immediately after Hitler had made his customary address on the evening of November 8th and had left the hall. The bomb was to be planted in a pillar behind the speaker's platform. Since Elser was a skilled cabinet maker and electrician and a tinkerer, they suggested that he was the man to do the job. If he did, they would arrange for his escape to Switzerland and for a large sum of money to keep him in comfort there. As a token of their seriousness, they promised him better treatment in the camp in the meanwhile. Better food, civilian clothes, plenty of cigarettes, for he was a chain smoker, and a carpenter's bench and tools. There, Elser constructed a crude but efficient bomb with an 8-day alarm clock mechanism and a contraption by which the weapon could also be detonated by an electric switch. Elser asserted that he was taken one night early in November to the beer cellar, where he installed his gadget in the well-placed pillar. On the evening of November 8th, at about the time the bomb was set to go off, he was taken by his accomplices, he said, to the Swiss frontier, given a sum of money, and, interestingly, a picture postcard of the interior of the beer hall, with the pillar in which he had placed his bomb, marked with a cross. But instead of being helped across the frontier, and this seems to have surprised the dim-witted fellow, he was nabbed by the Gestapo, postcard and all. Later he was coached by the Gestapo to implicate Best and Stevens at the coming state trial, in which he would be made the center of attention. Later, at Dachau, Elser told a similar story to Pastor Niemöller, who since has stated his personal conviction that the bombing was sanctioned by Hitler to increase his own popularity and stir up the war fever of the people. It is only fair to add that Gasevius, archenemy of Hitler, Himmler, and Schellenberg, believes, as he testified at Nuremberg and in his book, that Elser really attempted to kill Hitler, and that there were no Nazi accomplices. Schellenberg, who is less reliable, states that though he was suspicious at first of Himmler and Heydrich, he later concluded, after questioning the carpenter and after reading interrogations made while Elser was first drugged and then hypnotized, that it was a case of a genuine attempted assassination. The trial never came off. We know now that Himmler, for reasons best known to himself, didn't dare to have a trial. We also know, now, that Elser lived on at Sachsenhausen and then Dachau concentration camps, being accorded, apparently on the express orders of Hitler, who had personally gained so much from the bombing, quite humane treatment under the circumstances. But Himmler kept his eye on him to the last. It would not do to let the carpenter survive the war and live to tell his tale. Shortly before the war ended, on April 16, 1945, the Gestapo announced that Georg Elser had been killed in an Allied bombing attack the previous day. We know now that the Gestapo murdered him. Hitler talks to his generals. Having escaped assassination, or so it was made to seem, and quelled defiance among his generals, Hitler went ahead with his plans for the big attack in the West. On November 20th, he issued Directive No. 8 for the conduct of the war, ordering the maintenance of the state of alert so as to exploit favorable weather conditions immediately, and laying down plans for the destruction of Holland and Belgium. And then, to put courage in the faint-hearted and arouse them to the proper pitch he thought necessary on the eve of great battles, he summoned the commanding generals and general staff officers to the Chancellery at noon on November 23rd. It was one of the most revealing of the secret pep talks to his principal military chiefs, and thanks to the Allied discovery of some of the OKW files at Flensburg, it has been preserved in the form of notes taken by an unidentified participant. "The purpose of this conference," Hitler began, "is to give you an idea of the world of my thoughts, which govern me in the face of future events, and to tell you my decisions." His mind was full of the past, the present, and the future, and to this limited group he spoke with brutal frankness and great eloquence, giving a magnificent resume of all that had gone on in his warped but fertile brain, and predicting with deadly accuracy the shape of things to come. But it seems difficult to imagine that anyone who heard it could have had any further doubts that the man who now held the fate of Germany and the world in his hands had become beyond question a dangerous megalomaniac. "I had a clear recognition of the probable course of historical events," he said in discussing his early struggles, "and the firm will to make brutal decisions. As the last factor, I must name my own person in all modesty, irreplaceable. Neither a military man nor a civilian could replace me. Assassination attempts may be repeated. I am convinced of the powers of my intellect and of decision. No one has ever achieved what I have achieved. I have led the German people to a great height, even if the world does hate us now. The fate of the Reich depends only on me. I shall act accordingly." He chided the generals for their doubts when he made his hard decisions to leave the League of Nations, decree conscription, occupy the Rhineland, fortify it, and seize Austria. "The number of people who put trust in me," he said, "was very small." The next step, he declared in describing his conquests with a cynicism which it is unfortunate that Chamberlain never heard, was Bohemia, Moravia, and Poland. "It was clear to me from the first moment that I could not be satisfied with the Sudeten German territory. That was only a partial solution. The decision to march into Bohemia was made. Then followed the establishment of the Protectorate, and with that the basis for the conquest of Poland was laid, but I was not quite clear at that time whether I should start first against the East and then against the West, or vice versa. By the pressure of events it came first to the fight against Poland. One might accuse me of wanting to fight and fight again. In struggle I see the fate of all beings. Nobody can avoid fighting if he does not want to go under. The increasing number of German people required a larger Lebensraum. My goal was to create a rational relation between the number of people and the space for them to live in. The fight must start here. No nation can evade the solution of this problem. Otherwise it must yield and gradually go down. No calculated cleverness is of any help here. Solution only with the sword. A people unable to produce the strength to fight must withdraw." The trouble with the German leaders of the past, Hitler said, including Bismarck and Moltke, was insufficient hardness. The solution was possible only by attacking a country at a favorable moment. Failure to realize this brought on the 1914 war on several fronts. It did not bring a solution of the problem. "Today," Hitler went on, "the second act of this drama is being written. For the first time in 67 years, we do not have a two-front war to wage. But no one can know how long that will remain so. Basically, I did not organize the armed forces in order not to strike. The decision to strike was always in me." Thoughts of the present blessings of a one-front war brought the Führer to the question of Russia. Russia is at present not dangerous. It is weakened by many internal conditions. Moreover, we have the treaty with Russia. Treaties, however, are kept only as long as they serve a purpose. Russia will keep it only as long as Russia herself considers it to be to her benefit. Russia still has far-reaching goals, above all the strengthening of her position in the Baltic. We can oppose Russia only when we are free in the West. As for Italy, all depended on Mussolini, whose death can alter everything. Just as the death of Stalin, so the death of the Duce can bring danger to us. How easily the death of a statesman can come, I myself have experienced recently. Hitler did not think that the United States was yet dangerous, because of her neutrality laws, nor that her aid to the Allies yet amounted to much. Still, time was working for the enemy. The moment is favorable now. In 6 months it might not be so any more. Therefore, my decision is unchangeable. I shall attack France and England at the most favorable and earliest moment. Breach of the neutrality of Belgium and Holland is of no importance. No one will question that when we have won. We shall not justify the breach of neutrality as idiotically as in 1914. The attack in the West, Hitler told his generals, meant the end of the World War, not just a single action. It concerns not just a single question, but the existence or non-existence of the nation. Then he swung into his peroration. The spirit of the great men of our history must hearten us all. Fate demands from us no more than from the great men of German history. As long as I live, I shall think only of the victory of my people. I shall shrink from nothing and shall annihilate everyone who is opposed to me. I want to annihilate the enemy. It was a telling speech, and so far as is known, not a single general raised his voice either to express the doubts which almost all the army commanders shared about the success of an offensive at this time, or to question the immorality of attacking Belgium and Holland, whose neutrality and borders the German government had solemnly guaranteed. According to some of the generals present, Hitler's remarks about the poor spirit in the top echelons of the army and the general staff were much stronger than in the above account. Later that day, at 6 p.m., the Nazi warlord sent again for Brauchitsch and Halder, and to the former, the general staff chief was kept waiting outside the Führer's office like a bad boy, delivered a stern lecture on the spirit of Zosen. The Army High Command, OKH, was shot through with defeatism, Hitler charged, and Halder's general staff had a stiff-necked attitude which kept it from falling in with the Führer. The beaten Brauchitsch, according to his own account, given much later on the stand at Nuremberg, offered his resignation, but Hitler rejected it, reminding him sharply, as the commander-in-chief remembered, that I had to fulfill my duty and obligation just like every other soldier. That evening Halder scribbled a shorthand note in his diary. A day of crisis. In many ways, November 23, 1939 was a milestone. It marked Hitler's final decisive triumph over the army, which in the First World War had shunted Emperor Wilhelm II aside and assumed supreme political as well as military authority in Germany. From that day on, the one-time Austrian corporal considered not only his political but his military judgment superior to that of his generals, and therefore refused to listen to their advice or permit their criticism, with results ultimately disastrous to all. A breach had occurred, Brauchitsch told the Nuremberg Tribunal in describing the events of November 23rd, which was later closed, but was never completely mended. Moreover, Hitler's harangue to the generals that autumn day put a complete damper on any ideas Halder and Brauchitsch might have had, however tepidly, to overthrow the Nazi dictator. He had warned them that he would annihilate anyone who stood in his way, and Halder says Hitler had specifically added that he would suppress any opposition to him on the general staff with brutal force. Halder, for the moment at least, was not the man to stand up to such terrible threats. When, 4 days later, on November 27th, General Tomas went to see him at the prompting of Schacht and Popitz and urged him to keep after Brauchitsch to take action against the Führer, "Hitler has to be removed," Halder later remembered Tomas's saying. The general staff chief reminded him of all the difficulties. He was not yet sure, he said, that Brauchitsch would take part actively in a coup d'état. A few days later, Halder gave Gerdeler the most ludicrous reasons for not going on with the plans to get rid of the Nazi dictator. Hassel noted them down in his diary. Besides the fact that one does not rebel when face to face with the enemy, Halder added, according to Hassel, the following points. We ought to give Hitler this last chance to deliver the German people from the slavery of English capitalism. There is no great man available. The opposition has not yet matured enough. One could not be sure of the younger officers. Hassel himself appealed to Admiral Canaris, one of the original conspirators, to go ahead, but got nowhere. He has given up hope of resistance from the generals, the former ambassador confided to his diary on November 30th, and thinks it would be useless to try anything more along this line. A little later, Hassel noted that Halder and Brauchitsch are nothing more than caddies to Hitler. Nazi terror in Poland. First phase. Not many days after the German attack on Poland, my diary began to fill with items about the Nazi terror in the conquered land. Later one would learn that many another diary was filling with them too. Hassel, on October 19th, reported hearing of the shocking bestialities of the SS, especially toward the Jews. A little later he was confiding to his diary a story told by a German landlord in the province of Posen. The last thing he had seen there was a drunken district party leader who had ordered the prison opened. He had shot 5 whores and attempted to rape 2 others. On October 18th, Halder wrote down in his diary the main points of a talk he had had with General Edvard Wagner, the quartermaster general, who had conferred with Hitler that day about the future of Poland. That future was to be grim. We have no intention of rebuilding Poland, not to be a model state by German standards. Polish intelligentsia must be prevented from establishing itself as a governing class. Low standard of living must be conserved. Cheap slaves. Total disorganization must be created. The Reich will give the Governor General the means to carry out this devilish plan. The Reich did. A brief account of the beginning of Nazi terror in Poland, as disclosed by the captured German documents and the evidence at the various Nuremberg trials, may now be given. It was but a forerunner to dark and terrible deeds that would eventually be inflicted by the Germans on all the conquered peoples. But from first to last, it was worse in Poland than any place else. Here, Nazi barbarism reached an incredible depth. Just before the attack on Poland was launched, Hitler had told his generals at the conference on the Obersalzberg on August 22nd that things would happen which would not be to the taste of German generals, and he warned them that they should not interfere in such matters but restrict themselves to their military duties. He knew whereof he spoke. Both in Berlin and in Poland, this writer soon was being overwhelmed with reports of Nazi massacres. So were the generals. On September 10th, with the Polish campaign in full swing, Halder noted in his diary an example which soon became widely known in Berlin. Some toughs belonging to an SS artillery regiment, having worked 50 Jews all day on a job of bridge repairing, herded them into a synagogue and, as Halder put it, massacred them. Even General von Kukler, the commander of the Third Army, who was later to have few qualms, refused to confirm the light sentences of the court-martial meted out to the murderers, 1 year in prison, on the ground that they were too lenient. But the army commander-in-chief, Brauchitsch, quashed the sentences altogether, though not until Himmler had intervened with the excuse that they came under a general amnesty. The German generals, upright Christians that they considered themselves to be, found the situation embarrassing. On September 12th, there was a meeting on the Führer's railroad train between Keitel and Admiral Canaris, at which the latter protested against the atrocities in Poland. The lackey chief of OKW curtly replied that the Führer has already decided on this matter. If the army wanted no part in these occurrences, it would have to accept the SS and Gestapo as rivals. That is, it would have to accept SS commissars in each military unit to carry out the exterminations. I pointed out to General Keitel, Canaris wrote in his diary, which was produced at Nuremberg, that I knew that extensive executions were planned in Poland, and that particularly the nobility and the clergy were to be exterminated. Eventually, the world would hold the Wehrmacht responsible for these deeds. Himmler was too clever to let the generals wiggle out of part of the responsibility. On September 19th, Heydrich, Himmler's chief assistant, paid a visit to the Army High Command and told General Wagner of SS plans for the house-cleaning of Polish Jews, intelligentsia, clergy, and the nobility. Holder's reaction to such plans was put down in his diary after Wagner had reported to him. Army insists that house-cleaning be deferred until army has withdrawn and the country has been turned over to civil administration, early December. This brief diary entry by the Chief of the Army General Staff provides a key to the understanding of the morals of the German generals. They were not going to seriously oppose the house-cleaning, that is, the wiping out of the Polish Jews, intelligentsia, clergy, and nobility. They were merely going to ask that it be deferred until they got out of Poland and could escape the responsibility. And, of course, foreign public opinion must be considered. As Halder jotted down in his diary the next day, after a long conference with Brauchitsch about the house-cleaning in Poland, nothing must occur which would afford foreign countries an opportunity to launch any sort of atrocity propaganda based on such incidents. Catholic clergy, impractical at this time. The next day, September 21st, Heydrich forwarded to the Army High Command a copy of his initial house-cleaning plans. As a first step, the Jews were to be herded into the cities, where it would be easy to round them up for liquidation. The final solution, he declared, would take some time to achieve and must be kept strictly secret. But no general who read the confidential memorandum could have doubted that the final solution was extermination. Within 2 years, when it came time to carry it out, it would become one of the most sinister code names bandied about by high German officials to cover one of the most hideous Nazi crimes of the war. What was left of Poland after Russia seized her share in the east and Germany formally annexed her former provinces and some additional territory in the west was designated by a decree of the Führer of October 12th as the General Government of Poland, and Hans Frank appointed as its Governor General, with Seyss-Inquart, the Viennese Quisling, as his deputy. Frank was a typical example of the Nazi intellectual gangster. He had joined the party in 1927, soon after his graduation from law school, and quickly made a reputation as the legal light of the movement. Nimble-minded, energetic, well-read not only in the law but in general literature, devoted to the arts and especially to music, he became a power in the legal profession after the Nazis assumed office, serving first as Bavarian Minister of Justice, then Reichsminister without portfolio, and President of the Academy of Law and of the German Bar Association. A dark, dapper, bouncy fellow, father of five children, his intelligence and cultivation partly offset his primitive fanaticism, and up to this time made him one of the least repulsive of the men around Hitler. But behind the civilized veneer of the man lay the cold killer. The 42-volume journal he kept of his life and works, which showed up at Nuremberg, it was found in May 1945 by Lieutenant Walter Stein of the U.S. 7th Army in Frank's apartment at the Hotel Berghof near Neuhaus in Bavaria, was one of the most terrifying documents to come out of the dark Nazi world, portraying the author as an icy, efficient, ruthless, bloodthirsty man. Apparently it omitted none of his barbaric utterances. "The Poles," he declared the day after he took his new job, "shall be the slaves of the German Reich." When once he heard that Neurath, the protector of Bohemia, had put up posters announcing the execution of 7 Czech university students, Frank exclaimed to a Nazi journalist, "If I wished to order that one should hang up posters about every 7 Poles shot, there would not be enough forests in Poland with which to make the paper for these posters." Himmler and Heydrich were assigned by Hitler to liquidate the Jews. Frank's job, besides squeezing food and supplies and forced labor out of Poland, was to liquidate the intelligentsia. The Nazis had a beautiful code name for this operation: Extraordinary Pacification Action, Außerordentliche Befriedigungsaktion, or AB Action, as it came to be known. It took some time for Frank to get it going. It was not until the following late spring, when the big German offensive in the West took the attention of the world from Poland, that he began to achieve results. By May 30th, as his own journal shows, he could boast in a pep talk to his police aides of good progress. The lives of some thousands of Polish intellectuals taken, or about to be taken. "I pray you, gentlemen," he asked, "to take the most rigorous measures possible to help us in this task." Confidentially, he added that these were the Führer's orders. Hitler, he said, had expressed it this way: The men capable of leadership in Poland must be liquidated. Those following them must be eliminated in their turn. There is no need to burden the Reich with this. No need to send these elements to Reich concentration camps. They would be put out of the way, he said, right there in Poland. At the meeting, as Frank noted in his journal, the chief of the security police gave a progress report. About 2,000 men and several hundred women, he said, had been apprehended at the beginning of the extraordinary pacification action. Most of them already had been summarily sentenced, a Nazi euphemism for liquidation. A second batch of intellectuals was now being rounded up for summary sentence. Altogether, about 3,500 persons, the most dangerous of the Polish intelligentsia, would thus be taken care of. Frank did not neglect the Jews, even if the Gestapo had filched the direct task of extermination away from him. His journal is full of his thoughts and accomplishments on the subject. On October 7, 1940, it records a speech he made that day to a Nazi assembly in Poland, summing up his first year of effort. "My dear comrades, I could not eliminate all lice and Jews in only 1 year. Public amused," he notes down at this point. "But in the course of time, and if you help me, this end will be attained." A fortnight before Christmas of the following year, Frank closed a cabinet session at Krakow, his headquarters, by saying, "As far as the Jews are concerned, I want to tell you quite frankly that they must be done away with in one way or another. Gentlemen, I must ask you to rid yourself of all feeling of pity. We must annihilate the Jews." It was difficult, he admitted, to shoot or poison the 3.5 million Jews in the general government, but we shall be able to take measures which will lead somehow to their annihilation. This was an accurate prediction. The hounding of Jews and Poles from the homes which they and their families had dwelt in for generations began as soon as the fighting in Poland was over. On October 7th, the day after his peace speech in the Reichstag, Hitler appointed Himmler to be the head of a new organization, the Reich Commissariat for the Strengthening of German Nationhood, or RKFDV for short. It was to carry out the deportation of Poles and Jews, first from the Polish provinces annexed outright by Germany, and replace them by Germans and Volksdeutsche, the latter being Germans of foreign nationality who were streaming in from the threatened Baltic lands and various outlying parts of Poland. Halder had heard of the plan a fortnight before, noting in his diary that for every German moving into these territories, 2 people will be expelled to Poland. On October 9th, 2 days after assuming the latest of his posts, Himmler decreed that 550,000 of the 650,000 Jews living in the annexed Polish provinces, together with all Poles not fit for assimilation, should be moved into the territory of the general government east of the Vistula River. Within a year, 1,200,000 Poles and 300,000 Jews had been uprooted and driven to the east. But only 497,000 Volksdeutsche had been settled in their place. This was a little better than Halder's ratio, 3 Poles and Jews expelled to 1 German settled in their stead. It was an unusually severe winter, that of 1939-40, as this writer remembers, with heavy snows. And the resettlement carried out in zero weather and often during blizzards actually cost more Jewish and Polish lives than had been lost to Nazi firing squads and gallows. Himmler himself may be cited as authority. Addressing the SS Leibstandarte the following summer after the fall of France, he drew a comparison between the deportations which his men were beginning to carry out in the West with what had been accomplished in the East. "It happened in Poland in weather 40 degrees below zero, where we had to haul away thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, where we had to have the toughness, you should hear this but also forget it immediately, to shoot thousands of leading Poles. Gentlemen, it is much easier in many cases to go into combat with a company than to suppress an obstructive population of low cultural level, or to carry out executions, or to haul away people, or to evict crying and hysterical women." Already on February 21, 1940, SS Oberführer Richard Glucks, the head of the concentration camp inspectorate, scouting around near Krakow, had informed Himmler that he had found a suitable site for a new quarantine camp at Auschwitz, a somewhat forlorn and marshy town of 12,000 inhabitants, in which was situated, besides some factories, a former Austrian cavalry barracks. Work was commenced immediately, and on June 14th Auschwitz was officially opened as a concentration camp for Polish political prisoners, whom the Germans wished to treat with special harshness. It was soon to become a much more sinister place. In the meantime, the directors of IG Farben, the great German chemical trust, had discovered Auschwitz as a suitable site for a new synthetic coal, oil, and rubber plant. There, not only the construction of new buildings, but the operation of the new plant would have the benefit of cheap slave labor. To superintend the new camp and the supply of slave labor for IG Farben, there arrived at Auschwitz in the spring of 1940 a gang of the most choice ruffians in the SS, among them Josef Kramer, who would later become known to the British public as the Beast of Belsen, and Rudolf Franz Höss, a convicted murderer who had served 5 years in prison. He spent most of his adult life as first a convict and then a jailer, and who in 1946, at the age of 46, would boast at Nuremberg that at Auschwitz he had superintended the extermination of 2.5 million persons, not counting another 500,000 who had been allowed to succumb to starvation. For Auschwitz was soon destined to become the most famous of the extermination camps, Vernichtungslager, which must be distinguished from the concentration camps, where a few did survive. It is not without significance for an understanding of the Germans, even the most respectable Germans under Hitler, that such a distinguished, internationally known firm as IG Farben, whose directors were honored as being among the leading businessmen of Germany, God-fearing men all, should deliberately choose this death camp as a suitable place for profitable operations. Friction between the totalitarians. The Rome-Berlin axis became squeaky that first fall of the war. Sharp exchanges at various levels took place over several differences. The failure of the Germans to carry out the evacuation of the Volksdeutsche from the Italian South Tyrol, which had been agreed upon the previous June. Failure of the Germans to supply Italy with 1 million tons of coal a month. Failure of the Italians to ignore the British blockade and supply Germany with raw materials brought through it. Italy's thriving trade with Britain and France, including the sale to them of war materials. Ciano's increasingly anti-German sentiments. Mussolini, as usual, blew hot and cold, and Ciano recorded his waverings in his diary. On November 9th, the Duce had trouble composing a telegram to Hitler congratulating him on his escape from assassination. He wanted it to be warm, but not too warm, because in his judgment no Italian feels any great joy over the fact that Hitler escaped death, least of all the Duce. November 20th. For Mussolini, the idea of Hitler's waging war, and worse still, winning it, is altogether unbearable. The day after Christmas, the Duce was expressing a desire for a German defeat, and instructing Ciano to secretly inform Belgium and Holland that they were about to be attacked. But by New Year's Eve, he was talking again of jumping into the war on Hitler's side. Ciano conveyed the warning to the Belgian ambassador in Rome on January 2nd, noting the action in his diary. According to Weizsäcker, the Germans intercepted 2 coded telegrams from the ambassador to Brussels containing the Italian warning, and deciphered them. The chief cause of friction between the two Axis powers was Germany's pro-Russian policy. On November 30, 1939, the Soviet Red Army had attacked Finland, and Hitler had been placed in a most humiliating position. Driven out of the Baltic as the price of his pact with Stalin, forced to hurriedly evacuate the German families who had lived there for centuries, he now had to officially condone Russia's unprovoked attack on a little country which had close ties with Germany, and whose very independence as a non-communist nation had been won from the Soviet Union largely by the intervention of regular German troops in 1918. On October 9, 1918, this is a little-known, ludicrous tidbit of history, the Finnish Diet, under the impression that Germany was winning the war, elected by a vote of 75-25 Prince Friedrich Karl of Hesse to be King of Finland. Allied victory a month later put an end to this fantastic episode. It was a bitter pill to swallow, but he swallowed it. Strict instructions were given to German diplomatic missions abroad and to the German press and radio to support Russia's aggression and avoid expressing any sympathy with the Finns. This may have been the last straw with Mussolini, who had to cope with anti-German demonstrations throughout Italy. At any rate, shortly after the new year, 1940, on January 3rd, he unburdened himself in a long letter to the Führer. Never before, and certainly never afterward, was the Duce so frank with Hitler, or so ready to give such sharp and unpleasant advice. He was profoundly convinced, he said, that Germany, even if assisted by Italy, could never bring Britain and France to their knees or even divide them. To believe that is to delude oneself. The United States would not permit a total defeat of the democracies. Therefore, now that Hitler had secured his eastern frontier, was it necessary to risk all, including the regime, and sacrifice the flower of German generations in order to try to defeat them? Peace could be had, Mussolini suggested, if Germany would allow the existence of a modest, disarmed Poland, which is exclusively Polish. Unless you are irrevocably resolved to prosecute the war to a finish, he added, I believe that the creation of a Polish state would be an element that would resolve the war and constitute a condition sufficient for the peace. But it was Germany's deal with Russia which chiefly concerned the Italian dictator. Without striking a blow, Russia has in Poland and the Baltic profited from the war. But I, a born revolutionist, tell you that you cannot permanently sacrifice the principles of your revolution to the tactical exigencies of a certain political moment. It is my duty to add that one further step in your relations with Moscow would have catastrophic repercussions in Italy. Mussolini's letter not only was a warning to Hitler of the degeneration of Italo-German relations, but it hit a vulnerable target. The Führer's honeymoon with Soviet Russia, which was beginning to get on the nerves of both parties. It had enabled him to launch his war and destroy Poland. It had even given him other benefits. The captured German papers reveal, for instance, one of the best-kept secrets of the war. The Soviet Union's help in providing ports on the Arctic, the Black Sea, and the Pacific, through which Germany could import badly needed raw materials otherwise shut off by the British blockade. On November 10, 1939, Molotov even agreed to the Soviet government's paying the freight charges on all such goods carried over the Russian railways. Refueling and repair facilities were provided German ships, including submarines, at the Arctic port of Tyrybyurka, east of Murmansk. Molotov thought the latter port was not isolated enough, whereas Tyrybyurka was more suited because it was more remote and not visited by foreign ships. All through the autumn and early winter of 1939, Moscow and Berlin negotiated for increased trade between the two countries. By the end of October, Russian deliveries of raw stuffs, especially grain and oil, to Germany were considerable, but the Germans wanted more. However, they were learning that in economics as well as politics, the Soviets were shrewd and hard bargainers. On November 1st, Field Marshal Goering, Grand Admiral Raeder, and Colonel General Keitel, independently of each other, as Weizsäcker noted, protested to the German Foreign Office that the Russians were demanding too much German war material. A month later, Keitel was again complaining to Weizsäcker that Russian requirements for German products, especially machine tools for manufacturing munitions, were growing more and more voluminous and unreasonable. But if Germany wanted food and oil from Russia, it would have to pay for them in the goods Moscow needed and wanted. So desperate was the blockaded Reich for these necessities from Russia that later, on March 30, 1940, at a crucial moment, Hitler ordered that delivery of war material to the Russians should have priority even over that to the German armed forces. After the conquest of France and the lowlands, Goering informed General Tomas, the economic chief of OKW, that the Führer desired punctual delivery to the Russians only until the spring of 1941. Later on, he added, we would have no further interest in completely satisfying the Russian demands. At one point, the Germans threw in the unfinished heavy cruiser Lützow as part of current payments to Moscow. Earlier, on December 15th, Admiral Raeder proposed selling the plans and drawings for the Bismarck, the world's biggest battleship, 45,000 tons, then building, to the Russians if they paid a very high price. By the end of 1939, Stalin himself was personally participating in the negotiations at Moscow with the German trade delegation. The German economists found him a formidable trader. In the captured Wilhelmstrasse papers, there are long and detailed memoranda of three memorable meetings with the awesome Soviet dictator, who had a grasp of detail that stunned the Germans. Stalin, they found, could not be bluffed or cheated, but could be terribly demanding. And at times, as Dr. Schnurre, one of the Nazi negotiators, reported to Berlin, he became quite agitated. The Soviet Union, Stalin reminded the Germans, had rendered a very great service to Germany and had made enemies by rendering this assistance. In return, it expected some consideration from Berlin. At one conference at the Kremlin on New Year's Eve 1939-40, Stalin characterized the total price of the airplanes as out of the question. It represented a multiplication of the actual prices. If Germany did not wish to deliver the airplanes, he would have preferred to have this openly stated. At a midnight meeting in the Kremlin on February 8th, Stalin requested the Germans to propose suitable prices and not to set them too high, as had happened before. As examples were mentioned the total price of 300 million Reichsmarks for airplanes and the German valuation of the cruiser Lützow at 150 million Reichsmarks. One should not take advantage of the Soviet Union's good nature. On February 11, 1940, an intricate trade agreement was finally signed in Moscow providing for an exchange of goods, during the ensuing 18 months, of a minimum worth of 640 million Reichsmarks. This was in addition to the trade agreed upon during the previous August, amounting to roughly 150 millions a year. Russia was to get, besides the cruiser Lützow and the plans of the Bismarck, heavy naval guns and other gear, and some 30 of Germany's latest warplanes, including the Messerschmitt fighters 109 and 110, and the Ju-88 dive bombers. In addition, the Soviets were to receive machines for their oil and electric industries, locomotives, turbines, generators, diesel engines, ships, machine tools, and samples of German artillery, tanks, explosives, chemical warfare equipment, and so on. What the Germans got the first year was recorded by OKW. 1 million tons of cereals, 500,000 tons of wheat, 900,000 tons of oil, 100,000 tons of cotton, 500,000 tons of phosphates, considerable amounts of numerous other vital raw materials, and the transit of 1 million tons of soybeans from Manchuria. Back in Berlin, Dr. Schnurre, the Foreign Office's economic expert who had masterminded the trade negotiations for Germany and Moscow, drew up a long memorandum on what he had gained for the Reich. Besides the desperately needed raw materials which Russia would supply, Stalin, he said, had promised generous help in acting as a buyer of metals and raw materials in third countries. The agreement, Schnurre concluded, means a wide open door to the east for us. The effects of the British blockade will be decisively weakened. This was one reason why Hitler swallowed his pride, supported Russia's aggression against Finland, which was very unpopular in Germany, and accepted the threat of Soviet troops and airmen setting up bases in the three Baltic countries, to be eventually used against whom but Germany. Stalin was helping him to surmount the British blockade. But more important than that, Stalin still afforded him the opportunity of fighting a one-front war, of concentrating all his military might in the West for a knockout blow against France and Britain, and the overrunning of Belgium and Holland, after which, well, Hitler had already told his generals what he had in mind. As early as October 17, 1939, with the Polish campaign scarcely over, he had reminded Keitel that Polish territory is important to us from a military point of view as an advanced jumping-off point and for strategic concentration of troops. To that end, the railroads, roads, and communication channels are to be kept in order. As the momentous year of 1939 approached its end, Hitler realized, as he had told his generals in his memorandum of October 9th, that Soviet neutrality could not be counted on forever. In 8 months or a year, he had said, things might change. And in his harangue to them on November 23rd, he had emphasized that we can oppose Russia only when we are free in the West. This was a thought which never left his restless mind. The fateful year faded into history in a curious and even eerie atmosphere. Though there was world war, there was no fighting on land, and in the skies, the big bombers carried only propaganda pamphlets, and badly written ones at that. Only at sea was there actual warfare. U-boats continued to take their toll of British and sometimes neutral shipping in the cruel, icy northern Atlantic. In the South Atlantic, the Graf Spee, one of Germany's three pocket battleships, had emerged from its waiting area, and in 3 months had sunk 9 British cargo vessels totaling 50,000 tons. Then, a fortnight before the first Christmas of the war, on December 14, 1939, the German public was electrified by the news, splashed in flaming headlines and in bulletins flashed over the radio, of a great victory at sea. The Graf Spee, it was said, had engaged three British cruisers on the previous day 400 miles off Montevideo and put them out of action. But elation soon turned to puzzlement. 3 days later, the press announced that the pocket battleship had scuttled herself in the Plate estuary just outside the Uruguayan capital. What kind of a victory was that? On December 21st, the high command of the Navy announced that the Graf Spee's commander, Captain Hans Langsdorff, had followed his ship and thus fulfilled like a fighter and hero the expectations of his Führer, the German people, and the Navy. The wretched German people were never told that the Graf Spee had been severely damaged by the three British cruisers, which had outgunned, that it had had to put into Montevideo for repairs, that the Uruguayan government, in accordance with international law, had allowed it to remain for only 72 hours, which was not enough, that the hero, Captain Langsdorff, rather than risk further battle with the British with his crippled ship, had therefore scuttled it, and that he himself, instead of going down with her, had shot himself 2 days afterward in a lonely hotel room in Buenos Aires. The day before, the scuttling, Goebbels had made the German press play up a faked dispatch from Montevideo saying that Graf Spee had suffered only superficial damage, and that British reports that it had been severely crippled were pure lies. Nor were they told, of course, that, as General Jodl jotted in his diary on December 18th, the Führer was very angry about the scuttling of Graf Spee without a fight, and sent for Admiral Raeder, to whom he gave a dressing down. On December 12th, Hitler issued another top-secret directive, postponing the attack in the West, and stipulating that a fresh decision would not be made until December 27th, and that the earliest date for A Day would be January 1st, 1940. He advised that Christmas leaves could therefore be granted. According to my diary, Christmas, the high point of the year for Germans, was a bleak one in Berlin that winter, with few presents exchanged, Spartan food, the menfolk away, the streets blacked out, the shutters and curtains drawn tight, and everyone grumbling about the war, the food, and the cold. There was an exchange of Christmas greetings between Hitler and Stalin. "Best wishes," Hitler wired, "for your personal well-being as well as for the prosperous future of the peoples of the friendly Soviet Union." To which Stalin replied, "The friendship of the peoples of Germany and the Soviet Union, cemented by blood, has every reason to be lasting and firm." In Berlin, Ambassador von Hassel used the holidays to confer with his fellow conspirators, Popitz, Goerdeler, and General Beck, and on December 30th recorded in his diary the latest plan. It was to have a number of divisions stop in Berlin in transit from west to east. Then Witzleben was to appear in Berlin and dissolve the SS. On the basis of this action, Beck would go to Zossen and take the supreme command from Brauchitsch's hands. A doctor would declare Hitler incapable of continuing in office, whereupon he would be taken into custody. Then an appeal would be made to the people along these lines: prevention of further SS atrocities, restoration of decency and Christian morality, continuation of the war, but readiness for peace on a reasonable basis. But it was all unreal, all talk. And so confused were the plotters that Hassel devoted a long patch of his diary to the consideration of whether they should retain Göring or not. Göring himself, along with Hitler, Himmler, Goebbels, Ley, and other party leaders, used the new year to issue grandiose proclamations. Ley said, "The Führer is always right. Obey the Führer." The Führer himself proclaimed that not he, but the Jewish and capitalistic warmongers had started the war, and went on, "United within the country, economically prepared and militarily armed to the highest degree, we enter this most decisive year in German history. May the year 1940 bring the decision. It will be, whatever happens, our victory." On December 27th, he had again postponed the attack in the West by at least a fortnight. On January 10th, he ordered it definitely set for January 17th, 15 minutes before sunrise, 8:16 a.m. The Air Force was to begin its attack on January 14th, 3 days in advance, its task being to destroy enemy airfields in France, but not in Belgium and Holland. The two little neutral countries were to be kept guessing about their fate until the last moment. But on January 13th, the Nazi warlord suddenly postponed the onslaught again on account of the meteorological situation. The captured OKW file on D-Day in the West is thereafter silent until May 7th. Weather may have played a part in the calling off of the attack on January 13th, but we now know that two other events were mainly responsible: an unfortunate forced landing of a very special German military plane in Belgium on January 10th, and a new opportunity that now appeared to the North. On the very day, January 10th, that Hitler had ordered the attack through Belgium and Holland to begin on the 17th, a German military plane flying from Münster to Cologne became lost in the clouds over Belgium and was forced to land near Mechelen-sur-Meuse. In it was Major Helmut Rheinberger, an important Luftwaffe staff officer, and in his briefcase were the German plans, complete with maps, for the attack in the West. As Belgian soldiers closed in, the major made for some nearby bushes and lit a fire to the contents of his briefcase. Attracted by this interesting phenomenon, the Belgian soldiers stamped out the flames and retrieved what was left. Taken to military quarters nearby, Rheinberger, in a desperate gesture, grabbed the partly burned papers, which a Belgian officer had placed on a table, and threw them into a lighted stove. The Belgian officer quickly snatched them out. Rheinberger promptly reported to Luftwaffe headquarters in Berlin through his embassy in Brussels that he had succeeded in burning down the papers to insignificant fragments, the size of the palm of his hand. But in Berlin there was consternation in high quarters. Jodl immediately reported to Hitler on what the enemy may or may not know, but he did not know himself. "If enemy is in possession of all the files," he confided to his diary on January 12th after seeing the Führer, "the situation is catastrophic." That evening, Ribbentrop sent a most urgent wire to the German embassy in Brussels asking for an immediate report on the destruction of the courier baggage. On the morning of January 13th, Jodl's diary reveals, there was a conference of Göring with his air attaché in Brussels, who had flown post-haste back to Berlin, and the top Luftwaffe brass. Result? Dispatch case burned for certain, Jodl recorded. But this was whistling in the dark, as Jodl's journal makes clear. At 1 p.m. it noted, "Order to General Halder by telephone. All movements to stop." The same day, the 13th, the German ambassador in Brussels was urgently informing Berlin of considerable Belgian troop movements as a result of alarming reports received by the Belgian general staff. The next day, the ambassador got off another most urgent message to Berlin. The Belgians were ordering Phase D, the next-to-last step in mobilization, and calling up two new classes. The reason, he thought, was reports of German troop movements on the Belgian and Dutch frontiers, as well as the content of the partly unburned courier mail found on the German Air Force officer. By the evening of January 15th, doubts had risen in the minds of the top brass in Berlin whether Major Rheinberger had really destroyed the incriminating documents as he had claimed. "They were presumably burned," Jodl remarked after another conference on the matter. But on January 17th, the Belgian Foreign Minister, Paul-Henri Spaak, sent for the German ambassador and told him flatly, as the latter promptly reported to Berlin, that "the plane which made an emergency landing on January 10th had put into Belgian hands a document of the most extraordinary and serious nature, which contained clear proof of an intention to attack. It was not just an operations plan, but an attack order worked out in every detail, in which only the time remained to be inserted." The Germans were never quite sure whether Spaak was not bluffing. On the Allied side, the British and French general staffs were given copies of the German plan. There was a tendency to view the German papers as a plant. Churchill says he vigorously opposed this interpretation and laments that nothing was done about this grave warning. What is certain is that on January 13th, the day after Hitler was informed of the affair, he postponed the attack, and that by the time it again came up for decision in the spring, the whole strategic plan had been fundamentally changed. But the forced landing in Belgium and the bad weather were not the only reasons for putting off the attack. Plans for a daring German assault on two other little neutral states farther to the north had in the meantime been ripening in Berlin and now took priority. The phony war, so far as the Germans were concerned, was coming to an end with the approach of spring.